Thank you for joining us for episode 39 of Bite-Sized Blessings. This episode is by turns powerful, devastating, and joyful. I'm so very grateful to my guest, Maggie Hanley, for being so vulnerable and for sharing herself with me today. There are some trigger warnings with this episode, however. The discussion of suicide and the discussion of child abuse do occur. If you yourself or someone you know is threatened with thoughts of suicide, please call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. And if you suspect someone of abusing a child, please call the Child Help National Child Abuse Hotline at 1-800-422-4453. And now, Episode 39 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
I called the suicide hotline. It wasn't like I wanted to die. It was more like I didn't want to live. Destroyed, pretty much destroyed. I called the suicide hotline and I met a woman named Sarah Gilman, who I'm forever grateful for because she saved my life, literally saved my life. And she figured out what the hell was going on. I was misdiagnosed. I was actually bipolar, but because I was on SSRIs, and you can do a little research on this, bipolar people on SSRIs almost always kill themselves. Almost always. I have many things. This question was fascinating to me because it sounds so simple, and yet it's incredibly complicated. Where I started was I'm a multifaceted light and energy field. It's what we all are. But, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, you're an artist. And I said, no, that is not a self-determined title. It's an earned title. And I feel that that should be a title that is you are distinguished with by a greater judge than yourself. So I've never referred to myself as an artist until I did my website this year, because, you know, you got to know what it is. But I always called myself a painter. So that was my easy answer. And then I went on to think about it more deeply. So artists are always tasked with writing artist statements, and you have to write it about yourself, but you have to sound like somebody else is talking about you. And so I look to other people in terms of, you know, who am I? What am I? Often I look at their reflection of who they think I am. And so in the middle of thinking about your questions, I found something. I'm still kind of unpacking and sorting. And I found this amazing little gift tag that a former boss had given to me. I thought, I'm going to tell you about that. I helped she and her husband start a winery, and they had me do all the bottle designs, all the labels. And now here, nearly 17 years later, it's still their label. They stuck with the brand, and I'm just so flattered. And I just had a love affair with both of these people. Funny story about that. He was, you know, he has a very thick accent, and we were discussing names, and he said, well, I want to call it Forking Paths. And I went, oh, no. You get your first Australian intern in there and you're going to be the laughing stock. I mean, you can see how Forking Paths could go south. You can see that. So anyway, they wrote me, I think it was a birthday, and she wrote, Maggie is unique. A lover of wine, natural beauty, cheerful smile, devotion, stylish, marketing savvy, chutzpah, poetic, considerate, great taste, little mean streak, persuasive, gentle, lover of life, lover of people, lover of beauty and justice. And I thought, wow, that's nothing I could have written myself. My mom was a devout Catholic, a practicing Catholic, and Irish Catholic, but she got divorced. And I guess the church would have rather seen my father beat her to death than get a divorce. So she was excommunicated, but she kept going to church because it was on her terms. It's her relationship with God. So I was from a broken home. And this is really funny. I've always been a study in contrast, and this might have something to do with it. My mother remarried a Jew, and my father remarried a German. Very different. I loved church because it was fun. And back in the day, I'm 61 years old. So back in the day, every Friday afternoon, all the kids from the grade schools would walk to their various churches, right? The Presbyterians and the Methodists and the Catholics. And then the non-believers or non-denominational people, they got to go home early. Father McCarthy. In the summer, we had a little modest cottage on the lake, and he would stop by. And boy, could the guy drink my parents' booze. Wow. You know, he came and uninvited, just dropping by, and would stay for hours and hours and drinking with my parents. Here's what happened. Because so my piano teacher was like, okay, this midnight mass, which I loved, you're going to sing a solo. And I was like, gulp. And I'm like, what do I have to sing? She says, Ave Maria. So my mother, of course, brought my stepfather to midnight mass to hear me sing. Then following Christmas, my stepfather got me, oh my God, a baby grand piano, because I was never had to be told to practice. Never. It was my escape. So then the next year, she said, now you're going to play Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring on the pipe organ. And I was like, oh my God, I did it. And my mother brought my stepfather, my Jewish stepfather. And on the way out, my mother was told that she needn't bring my stepfather back to St. Gabriel's because he's Jewish. And I'm like, wasn't Jesus Jewish? And this is the guy that's been guzzling my parents' booze, had the nerve to say he's uninvited. And that was it for me. That was it. I kept going. That was my disconnect with that organized religion. Plus, I wasn't really liking what they were saying about girls and women. Really didn't dig that, that we were less than or there to serve. It was really clear to me that men wrote the Bible, and that seemed awfully self-serving. The full circles, to me, feel like miracles and magic. My grandfather, who was a very early influence, he was caretaker to the largest collection of Western art east of the Mississippi. So I'm bumbling around 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, Lakota, you know, ritual rattles and eagle feathers and Navajo rugs and Apache masks. I was surrounded by this stuff, giant 6-foot by 5-foot paintings of early Native American life. I was hooked, totally hooked. While I was at 171, I had a show at the Rockwell Museum because all that collection was housed in a museum. And I ended up showing there. And I thought, well, Grandpa's happy. You know, so these full circles are terribly interesting to me, especially now that I've come back to New Mexico. Stepchildren went off to college, it seemed that I was quite unnecessary and somewhat invisible and almost annoying. My time there was done. And I guess I wasn't needed anymore. Cook, cleaning lady, that sort of stuff. So I came out back out to Santa Fe, where I came to New Mexico to get my college education. You know, through my Social Security card and my birth certificate and one expensive bracelet in my suitcase, came to Santa Fe, visited my friends, went to Seattle, visited my girlfriends up there. They gave me a hat, a coat, a pair of mittens, a couple scarves, a few sweaters, and said, you are not going back to New York. Go back to Santa Fe. So at 50 years old, I started over with $900. So that kind of lends its way to a miraculous story that when I moved back here, it was really an incredible sequence of events because, you know, in Santa Fe, they say, well, it's either going to embrace you and roll out the red carpet or it's going to spit you out. You will not fit anywhere. You will make no progress. I got here. I laid in a motel bed for about 3 days and cried and took baths and slept and cried and took baths and slept. And finally, on the third day, I was like, I'm hungry. So I went out and got a newspaper and sat and ate some breakfast. within a day, I got a place to house sit for 3 weeks, and they gave me their car and access to their computer, and their two lovely dogs gave me love. And it was Christmas Eve. And I remember, my God, look at this Kiva fireplace. I miss these so much, but there's no firewood. 5 minutes, no kidding. Knock on the door. I go and answer it. Beautiful Hispanic woman saying to me, "We see that your wood pile needs refreshing. Would you like some firewood?" And I was like, "Are you joking?" So then it's just an amazing sequence of events. So I get my first gig. I'm looking in the paper and I'm like, I need a gig. And so I answered a call and I became the project manager for Almas de la Plaza Santa Fe, put on by Robert Drummond and funded by the New Mexico Film Foundation. So my name was on a plaque in the plaza within months of living here. I realized now, you know, over 60, that when miracles are happening, you don't always know that they are. Example was, I was 17 years old. I left high school early and went off to college because I was really itching to get into the studio arts, you know, and I'd gone as far as I could in high school. So I was in a car accident as I was commuting to this community college, and I put my face through a Volkswagen windshield. What happened was we sued and I got a sum of money. And that money provided me with the freedom to get the education that I wanted, not what my parents wanted. I mean, they would have stuck me in a pink collar wardrobe in a minute. But instead, fine arts, dance, humanities, things that just really interested me. That was the silver lining. So I'm, you know, a vain 18-year-old girl, 17-year-old girl with scars all up on down her face. And that was a miracle too. Because that, having those Mars on my face, made me a little more real. It was good for me. And it launched the beginning of my life. So I didn't begrudge that much at all. Gordon is a full circle as well.
No, no.
Seeing a boy on a bus and just going, wow. I couldn't take my eyes off him. And now, almost 40 years later, showing up as the love of my life. I mean, I can hardly believe it. And I was not very open. I was pretty heartbroken and alone for 10 years. My heart was clamped shut. It was shut right down. So anyway, I'm talking to my beloved Gordon on the telephone more and more frequently. And I could tell he just really wanted to get to know me. He asked questions, always. Wanting to know more about me, so on and so forth. I'm a tarot card reader and have been for 35 years. And I had a morning client that I was doing a reading for. But the night before, Gordon said, "Now I want to have a sit down date with you tomorrow morning." And we were going to look at, we had only been talking on the phone, but we were going to look at each other. It's going to be our first glance at each other, right? Because he was in Hong Kong. And he wanted to turn the phone around and tour me through the night streets of Hong Kong. So I thought, wow, it's like our first date. At the time, I was working on the first self-portrait I had done since college. And in this self-portrait, I have a red string that has wishbones tied to it. So it's a necklace of wishbones. When he called to, you know, he texted and said, "Let me know when you're available." So I texted him back and I said these words. I said, "Gosh, I wish I could just come over and have tea with you. But in the meantime, I'm going to work on painting these wishbones on this self-portrait. And yes, I have completed my tarot reading with this woman in New York." Oh my God. He called within like 20 seconds. And he's like, "Are you kidding me?" And I was like, "What?" And he said, "You hit all three." I'm like, "I don't know what you're talking about." And he said, "I've just completed the chorus for a song I've written about us. And here's the chorus. So spread the cards, throw the bones, stories in the tea untold." And it's been going on like that ever since. Talk about affirming a connection. That's magic.
Just a little background on Gordon. He's a musician.
just so people know. Okay. And I mean, among many other things, but he's also a musician and he writes songs. And you met him in Seattle. And how old was he when you first met him?
We're the same age. So 23. Neither one of us were looking for a relationship, I'll say that. But I'm glad I gave it a chance because this may very well turn out to be the greatest love of my life.
Well, obviously, I love this really beautiful circular story of you and Gordon and just the synchronicity and the magic in it. And then, you know, here you are, and it's 40 years later, you reconnect. He finds you, and not only just finds you, he's like determined.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was.
He's like determined. So in the previous incarnation of your relationship, you left this lasting mark.
Yes, on each of us. I realized that what I'd been craving so much in those 10 years alone and doing the hard work and going in the cave and working with the shadow and all that stuff and taking responsibility, I was yearning for another pair of eyes to look at, you know, just to look at and to be looked at. I mean, to love and be loved in return. It's simple. It's terribly simple. My childhood, you know, I used playing piano and then in drums and timpani and vibes and, you know, all that crap. So music and dance and art as escapes from what was not a pleasant childhood for me. I'll say this really quickly and just hold on to your hat and know that I'm okay with it now. But I was conceived in rape and I didn't get that validated or confirmed, I should say, until I was about 27, but I knew something was off. My mother, man, I kind of fucked up her plan. She wanted to leave that guy before he beat her to death and no birth control. And he was raping her and she got pregnant again. And I get it. I get how you might resent that kid. And I'm only telling you this because I knew somewhere in my gut, something's really wrong here because I'm not that bad. She should be nicer. When I went off to college and gained my freedom, thank you, car accident, and I come out to New Mexico, I fell in love for the first time in my life with a man named Gary. And it was an instant meeting, too. And he just came across a room and climbed up and over a wrought iron rail, hit his head on a hanging plant, sat down next to me and said, "Do I know you?" And then proceeded to amuse me for the next 4 or 5 years. So I knew that I would be terribly unhappy if I stayed in Albuquerque, and I had graduated and I was like, okay, what's next? If he's not going to commit, I don't want to live in this town where I know he is and it's going to drive me crazy. So I kind of went like this on a map and went boom, and I chose Seattle. Perfect time to be there. Oh my God. So off I go, and I sold my car and I quit my jobs. And my friend John said, "So how are you getting there?" And I'm like, "I don't know. The universe provides. We'll see." He goes, "Well, this weekend is going to be my birthday and I need to get out of town. Why don't I drive you up there?" And I went, "Really?" So I get up there and I'm having my life and I get a job at this fancy restaurant. And one night they say, "Maggie, phone call for you, take it in the kitchen." And I'm like, "Nobody knows me. Who would call me?" And I get on the phone and he's like, "Hi, baby, I'm in the Space Needle, but I can't see you." I was like, "Oh, you're here?" He came to see me. And then I went to see him at a Christmas, and then he came back again and visited. And then it was decided that he was going to move to Seattle. And he had it all figured out. He had a house on Mercer Island. He had a job. And he's like, "I'm coming. I don't want to be without you. You're it for me." And I was like, "Oh my God, dream come true." And 2 weeks before he got there, he was killed in a motorcycle accident. And, but we had a wonderful times. And he always wanted to know what I dreamed. And one night I went, "Oh, I had this amazing dream. This brown, big horse came to me and was nudging me and nudging me." And what it ultimately did is it wanted help giving birth to a pony. So I went in, it laid down, we're in this, then I'm like yanking on the pony. And he goes, oh, you've got to call Yaya, who was his neighbor. Old Greek woman, read coffee grounds. She reads coffee grounds, right? He goes, you got to tell her that dream. And I had met her before, so I wasn't a perfect stranger. And I said, Yaya. And I told her this whole dream. And she goes, what color was the horse? And I went, reddish brown. She's like, good, because white means death. Gary was like, he was so into his Greek neighbors. It was like three generations over there. And he said, I want to take you to Greece someday, baby. You've got a paint over there. You won't believe the light. So an old friend of mine came 2 years ago, came for the Santa Fe International Film Festival. And she was coming with two filmmakers from New York. And they pulled me in on the whole thing. It was really fun. And while Catherine was here, she said, I've been invited to go to Santorini, Greece, to stay at an eco-friendly resort by a woman I know. And she's been inviting me for years and I've never, you want to go? And I was like, yeah, I do. Gary was in a coma for a while, 3 days. And I was going back and forth and back and forth, like, do I go there? I didn't know what to do. And so a friend of mine, Tamara, said, well, you got to get out of bed and, you know, take a shower, eat some food. I was a mess. I was really knocked right off. Yeah, knocked right off my center. Yeah. So I got dressed and she says, well, we're going to Whidbey Island. I was like, okay. I was like, whatever, take me anywhere. Walking the dogs on the beach. So we're on the beach. And I hear Gary's voice in my head. And he said, take a good look around for me, baby. Take it all in. Let me look through your eyes. So I'm, you know, scanning this amazing waterscape. And then we went over to her friend's house and they were having tea in the kitchen and talking. And I needed to cry a little bit, stare. And it was raining that day. And we're on Cemetery Road. That's where Jesse lived. And I'm looking out the window and I'm doing this thing with really up close focus where the raindrops, they come down and they collect and then they go faster. And I was just like staring at that. And I see something in the distance and I look and I went, there was a man walking down Cemetery Road and he had two horses on a lead, one behind the other, and they were both white. I went to Greece to say goodbye to Gary. I've been missing him my whole life. Gary and I had one fight in our life, one. I don't even remember what it was about, but I was really mad at him. So he came to pick me up and he took me to his father's house. And they had two cherry trees there and Gary's signature hammock. He had a hammock everywhere he went, on the boat, in his apartment, his father's house. He used to bring a hammock when he visited me in Seattle. He's crazy. I loved him. And so what he did was he laid me down in this hammock and he fed me cherries and made me spit the pits at him until I wasn't mad anymore. Is that creative or what? I had this bad moment. In Greece, it was so freaking hot and it was so humid. And I had a bad knee. I had a knee injury. And so walking, you know, in these, I just had a moment where I thought, what am I having, a heat stroke? My face was bright red. And I remember thinking to myself, you thought I'd like it here? And I look over on the wall and there it is. A single cherry sitting right on the wall. A cherry. Okay, so I'm a little girl. We're 8 years old. My mother has left and remarried, you know, my Jewish stepfather. My sister and I are playing kickball out in the street. My dad comes by in this light blue T-bird. And he's like, get in, girls. And we did. And he took us, without it, my mother knowing, for the weekend. He was a big drinker. And he had rented a cottage next door to this bar that was on Cuca Lake, which is probably where I was conceived in the first place. I even have a picture of us at the bar, my father and I. and my sister and Mike Cunningham, this other guy, drinking Boilermakers with him at the Switzerland Inn. Something happened during that time, and I didn't know it for many, many years. Fast forward to I'm in Seattle, and a friend of mine, I don't know anything about rebirthing. And he goes, well, I'll give you a little example. I worked in a flower shop. We had closed it. And he was like, lay down on the floor. And we did this thing. And this vision went through my head like a little lightning bolt. It came and it went. And I guess I must have flinched or something. But he said, what was that? I said, it was nothing. It was crazy, weird, random thing. He goes, what was it? I'm like, I don't even want to tell you. He goes, what was it? I'm like, okay, I'm laying in bed. My father is to my right and he has his cock in my mouth and I can't fucking breathe. And then I put it away. You know, I just forgot it again. I just pushed it way down. So I'm doing really well in Seattle, but I get a recommend. Because I have this mystery about my past. Like, I don't know if it's true or not. I went through 10 years of therapy to deal with what got uprooted. And more of the memory came back. And I wasn't really telling anybody. But I did tell my girlfriend, Vera. And Vera says, come down to LA. I know this amazing woman named Annie Bosinger. And she does work with children who have birth trauma. And it could, because it comes out in all kinds of bad behavior and acting out and that sort of thing. And what she does is she goes through the conception and birthing all the way up through the birthing process. And with no information whatsoever about any details of what the birth was like, what happened to mother, what were the procedures, you know, so on and so forth. She just goes at these kids and figures out what it is and fixes them. So I went there to do this with her because she was starting to realize that she could go further than the birth. It's going to take us 2 days to do this, right? And she just puts a box of Kleenex and she goes, you don't have to do anything. You just watch and listen. And she does a whole timeline, like a physical timeline along these two sleeping bags. She tells you about your conception. She goes, oh, the sperm, the egg is fighting with the sperm. Something bad is going on here. Something bad is going on here. This egg does not want to accept this sperm. So they're fighting. They're fighting. And then she takes me to my moment right before I come into the world. Oh, this always kills me. She said, Jesus is on your right and Mary is on your left. And they're comforting you before you go into this life that you've agreed to, that you know it's going to be hard. You know it, but you agreed to it. You wanted to do this level of learning and they're comforting you. They're letting you go. And I was a very quiet baby, apparently. I didn't want to draw much attention to myself. And she said that they would come to me in my crib at night and be with me. And man, did I ever feel that viscerally. I knew she didn't know anything about me. Nothing. The seed and the sperm, they're fighting. This is not really a happy union here. This is not about love, you know, and that happens on a biological level. I'm convinced. Then she went further. She went to the violation. She went straight away there. She's like, you can't breathe. Oh my God, that's your father. You can't breathe. He's choking. She goes, oh, no, he's. She saw it. She confirmed it. So then I talked to my mother when that was all done. Boy, was that excruciating. I was like, Mom, you know, you used to talk about dad coming home drunk and belligerent and hitting you. And now I'm a grown woman. And it's like, when did you stop having consensual sex with Tom Hanley? And she said, right after Nora was born. Then she went, oh, Nora's my older sister. Incredible. Many people will go their whole lives without really knowing. Fast forward to 2 days before the death of my father. I'm on the phone with my stepmother and she's pissed. And I'm like, what's going on? She says, I won't imitate her. Thick German accent. She goes, oh, I'm going to tell you something. She said, your cousins, Brian and Billy, were here visiting your father a couple of days ago. And I overhear a conversation that they're having. Now she's mad because he didn't tell her something. And I'm flipping out. So she proceeds to tell me the story. I was like, what did they say? And she said, well, it was Billy, I guess, because he was older at the time. Brian's more my age. And then Billy said, gosh, remember those three men that you lived with in the house on 2nd Street after Maureen left with the girls? They were really nice guys. Clara, my stepmother, is pissed off because she never knew that. So he was living with three other men while he was dating her, and she never knew it. And she's mad about this, right? It's sort of irrationally mad in my mind, until she tells me this. She says, those three men, two of them suicided themselves because they were brought up on charges of child sexual abuse. And I went, oh my God. I mean, my brain exploded. I was like, thanks for the gift. I get a call from my half brother, the one who was raised by my father. And he goes, oh my God. He goes, I'm driving from, where was he, Vermont, and driving to Rochester, New York. And they're like trying to make me make these decisions about end of life care and hospice about dad. So the next day comes and he calls me up and he says, listen, dad, and I figured it all out and we have a plan, and they're going to hospice him. So he's comfortable now. And his eyes are closed and I'm in the room with him. I have some earbuds in his ear. And when I count to three, I'm going to push in the jack. And you can talk to him for as long as you want and say anything you want. I was merciful because it's in my nature. I told him it was okay to go. And I told him, I hope you watch over me a little better now where you're going than when you did, than how you did when you were here. After 9/11, I went into a deep, 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 deep depression because I had changed my whole life, given up a career to go back, not to be very appreciated, raising these two children and the husband. I fell into a really deep clinical depression. And I had a girlfriend real worried about me. And she goes, ooh, I'm taking you to the doctor. And I was like, whatever. I was diagnosed with clinical depression and was put on a course of SSRIs, antidepressants, a very specific antidepressant. And I was on them for 11 years. And I took a year and a half sabbatical to not work at any job and just to paint. And I went off that medication. I titrated off it, you know, the proper way. And my brain exploded. It was like an electrical fire in my brain neurons. It was the most, I can't even describe it. That's as close as I get. And I had a full on psychic breach, mental breakdown. And I called the suicide hotline. It wasn't like I wanted to die. It was more like I didn't want to live. It was too much pain. It was just too much, too much, too much. This was, you know, after the divorce, it was after my mother's passing. I was just destroyed, pretty much destroyed. I called the suicide hotline and I got express lined into help right away. And I met a woman named Sari Gilman, who I'm forever grateful for because she saved my life, literally saved my life. And she figured out what the hell was going on. I was misdiagnosed. I was actually bipolar, but because I was on SSRIs, and you can do a little research on this, bipolar people on SSRIs almost always kill themselves, almost always. It's the absolute wrong drug for a bipolar person. But because I was on them for 11 years, what it did was it flipped me into this very specific type of bipolar that's called rapid cycling bipolar. It's hell on earth. Or it was. It was. So when that started out, to get me out of crisis and to stabilize me, I was on 5 different drugs. And I really didn't want to live then. So we made some adjustments. And now I'm on 1 low-dose drug that, you know, a proper drug. It's actually was designed for people with epilepsy and has to do with seizures. They discovered that it maintains your balance in bipolar people, some bipolar people. And I'm one of the lucky ones. And that to me is a miracle. She saved my life. I was so close to death. You know, it was kind of one of those things where you might walk out in front of a bus by mistake. You know, that's how bad I didn't want to be here anymore. If anybody who's known me for 30 or 40 years would notice a remarkable change in me, the change is on the inside, and it's in my head, and it's in my words that I say to myself. It's in the feelings that I have about myself and with myself. You were talking about miracles and magic, and I guess I came to the place where I thought love is a miracle and self-love is magical. That's where the magic comes in my experience. And it has made me more magical, the love has. And the more I notice, I notice a lot more coincidences, and there's more wonderment. And I experience observing these fragile filaments of phenomena woven in a life that is, it's kind of self-perpetuating. The magic becomes self-perpetuating. And the key is self-love. I swear they should teach it in kindergarten.
Listening to episode 39 of Bite-Sized Blessings, the podcast all about the magic and spirit that surrounds us, if only we open our eyes to it. I need to thank my guest today, Maggie Hanley, for sharing her story, as well as the many musical creators of all the groovy music used in this episode: Music L Files, Chilled Music, Raphael Crux, Brian Holtz, Kevin McLeod, Agnes Vilmagia, Music Hauled, Dream Heaven, and Frank Schroeder. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to books, art, music, and changemakers I think will lighten and brighten your day. It's hard to pick just one miracle in this episode with which you can go out and emulate Maggie and change the world. I'd say forgiveness is a pretty big one. It's hard, and many of us absolutely find it so difficult to achieve. But I'd have to say, after careful reflection, that self-love is the most powerful and beautiful miracle in this episode. I imagine that if in kindergarten we were all taught to love ourselves, to love our neighbors, and then take that beautiful and powerful energy out into the world as we are growing up. So I'm going to go with self-love. I think that's the most powerful miracle here. So thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Maggie. Learn to love yourself and then go out and change the world.